This morning, America's First News starts right after this. Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. Fortunately, GEICO makes it easy to bundle your home and car insurance. It's a good thing, too, because having a home is hard work. Go to GEICO.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. GEICO.com. Easy.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This morning, with your host, Gordon Deal.
A pivot by the FBI. Good morning, I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koshenka, on this Tuesday, January 18th. Glad you could be with us, and here's what we have for you this hour.
The FBI now says the hostage situation at a Texas synagogue on Saturday was terrorism. Plus, hear how the rabbi says he and others escaped the gunman.
Winter storm Izzy has brought more misery, this time to New England, as it makes its final push into Canada.
The South Pacific island of Tonga is so isolated after a volcano and tsunami 3 days ago, rescuers can't access it yet to examine the damage.
And scientists searching our sewage to find trends about COVID.
Scientists take these samples, they run it through the same kind of equipment, the PCR equipment that people are familiar with, the traditional COVID test, and they measure COVID levels in sewage to try and determine what's going on in that population in terms of which way things are trending.
Kyle Bagenstow said USA Today on alternate methods of finding peaks and valleys of the coronavirus. The Texas rabbi who endured a 10-hour standoff at a Dallas area synagogue says he and the other hostages fled after he threw a chair at the gunman. Rabbi Charlie Citron Walker said he saw an opportunity and made sure the other two hostages were ready. He told CBS Mornings that the exit was not far away.
A huge thank you to the three amazing individuals who joined me on Shabbat morning to pray in person. And somehow, together, we made it through that traumatic ordeal.
Meanwhile, in a reversal, the FBI released a statement yesterday calling the standoff a terrorism-related matter in which the Jewish community was targeted. 44-year-old Malik Akram, a British national, was killed after an FBI SWAT team swept into the Congregation Beth Israel in Colleyville. Two of Mr. Akram's teenage children were detained for questioning in Manchester, England. The rabbi and others in the congregation had previously taken active shooter drills from the Colleyville Police Department, the FBI, the Anti-Defamation League, and a local group called the Secure Community Network. From Georgia to parts of Canada, winter storm Izzy grounded planes, stranded motorists, and knocked out power. More from this morning's Mike Gavin.
More than 4,200 flights in the U.S. were canceled or delayed yesterday. Small pockets of power outages remain this morning in West Virginia, Kentucky, North Carolina, and Tennessee. Parts of Ohio on Lake Erie recorded 27 inches of snow, while areas of New York State, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and South Carolina received more than 20 inches. Atlanta saw its first snow in 4 years, and some regions in North Carolina had record snowfalls. Blustery conditions were predicted across much of the region into today. Gordon.
Thanks, Mike. Asheville, North Carolina got 10 inches of snow and broke the snowfall record that was previously set in 1891. At some stretches over the weekend, more than 80 million people were under winter weather alerts. The small outer islands of Tonga have suffered extensive damage from a massive volcanic eruption and tsunami, with an entire village destroyed and many buildings missing. The update today from a Tongan diplomat raises fears of more deaths and injuries. Tonga police say the confirmed death toll stood at 2, but Alexander Matiu with the Asia-Pacific Red Cross says with communications in the South Pacific Island nation cut, the true extent of casualties was not clear.
What we do know is that the ashfall has been significant and the tsunami waves have been destructive, but we don't know the extent of the damage.
The Tongan Navy reported the area was hit by waves estimated to be 15 to 30 feet high. The Hunga Tonga Hunga Ha'apai volcano sent tsunami waves across the Pacific Ocean and was heard some 1,400 miles away in New Zealand when it erupted on Saturday. One official says a wave may have washed over the entire small island of Atata, population 100. Welcome into Tuesday. Thanks for spending some time with us. Are global supply chain problems getting better or worse Where are we in this saga? In-depth analysis from Rob Garrison, global supply chain expert at Mercado Labs, an international trading platform. Rob, same, better, or worse?
Yeah, same to worse, I would say, would be my prognosis, unfortunately. That's, I know nobody wants to hear that, but I really haven't seen too many dramatic improvements, and of course, this latest variant hasn't helped.
I was somewhat optimistic when President Biden, a couple of months ago, said that there an agreement had been reached to create more operating hours at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach, you know, to untangle that long line of ships waiting to dock. But I think it's more complicated than that, right? There's just not enough truck drivers, for one, once that stuff gets unloaded.
It's a bit more complicated. And the way I try to simplify it, because I've been doing this my whole life, so I just try to boil it down to the essence of this thing. So when you think about a chain, just think about a necklace, for example, and each one of those links is connected. If one link breaks, obviously you can't wear the necklace, right? It falls off your neck. And the supply chain is a chain for a reason. It's a series of links, and the port's one of them. So improvements in a port is helpful. You certainly want that. But to your point and where you're headed is another link is the truck drivers. Another link is the warehouses. Another link is the factories. So it's a complicated process. And right now, unfortunately, each one of those links has challenges.
All right. So based on what we just discussed, then, does the government need to step in?
150%, I would say.
So how so? Is it doing enough, in your opinion?
Well, the two things that underpin these links that we talk about, one is infrastructure. For the most part, we have that. We can use some improvements like the one you described at the port for sure, and it seems like they are stepping there, which is good. But the other key link, piece to the link, is the people. And right now, of course, for all the right reasons, the government's trying to protect everybody and locking down many, many things. And that's the labor. That's the people that drive our trucks or operate those cranes that unload the boats, or work in the warehouses to get the trucks loaded, or work in the factories to produce our products. And so that's the next thing we really need help with, is to figure out how we can get more available workforce deployed throughout that chain.
Boy, so what's the answer? Let's imagine a scenario where Rob Garrison at Mercado Labs is now the supply chain czar. I don't know, announce changes that magically could be implemented starting 9 a.m. the next workday. I mean, what would they be?
Yeah, I think they're on the right track with this. And so I can't wave a magic wand, but I think 100% the things that are being done to get the workforce back to working are the right things. We need to get more testing so we can feel comfortable that the people showing up to do that work are safe and don't get the rest infected, because it doesn't do any good if they're not tested and the rest of the workforce goes down. And then secondly, we want to advance those therapeutics so that we know that if people do get sick, it's a much less risky environment for them. So the vaccinations are on track, it looks like. We need to get the tests out quickly, and we need to get the anecdotes out quickly. Then we can get our workforce back on task. People want to work, and we can get our supply chains back up and running.
We're speaking with Rob Garrison, global supply chain expert, also CEO of Mercado Labs, which is an international trading platform. You said people want to work, but there seems to be a lot more jobs available than people going for them. What's this about in your mind?
Well, people want to work, of course, but they also want to know that they're safe. And so there's a lot of hesitation to go into a workforce with lots of other folks. Imagine a warehouse where you're going in there and there's a 200 other people in there, and you don't feel like you're walking into a safe environment. You've got families that, members that you've got to protect and everything else that you want to protect, including your own health. And so I think once we can get people comfortable that they can walk into a safe environment, they want to go back to work. I think we've all had, at least all the people that I talk to, have had enough of being sort of quarantined, and we'd like to get back at it. Safely.
Yeah. How much does it come down to in your mind of, say, just making more stuff in the U.S., like semiconductor chips, for example?
Yeah, that's an excellent question and an excellent solution. There's way too much stuff that we've outsourced. A lot of it for good reason. Sometimes that gets a bad rap. A lot of times there's a good reason that things were offshored. But the critical things certainly need to be made here. The challenge with that, and the reason I didn't offer that as an anecdote to this thing, is it's going to take a long time. There's a lot of capital that's required for those things. There's lots of permitting that needs to take place before we can build those things. There's all kinds of labor requirements that we have here because we're pretty stringent in terms of making sure our people are safe. And so it's just going to take a while. So I think everybody's moving in that direction, but it will be at least several years, if not more, before we can rally the capital and the expertise and the will to start rebuilding those factories.
Thanks, Rob. Rob Garrison, global supply chain expert at Mercado Labs. 20 minutes now after the hour on This Morning. Here's Jennifer Koschenka.
And now, the three big things you need to know. Number one.
The winter storm that slammed much of the south with ice is moving north through Canada as hundreds of thousands remain without power in parts of the southeast. Parts of Ohio, New York, and Pennsylvania got more than a foot of snow. Chris Hornstein is Pittsburgh's acting public works director.
Just asking folks to be patient. We're making our way to you now. We have 60 trucks on the road right now. We'll have 40 more trucks on the road.
More than 3,200 flights were canceled yesterday.
Number two.
A day before the Senate was expected to take up legislation on voting rights that is looking likely to fail, Martin Luther King Jr.'s eldest son condemned federal lawmakers over their inaction. Martin Luther King III told ABC voting rights legislation needs to pass.
This year, we are almost laserly focused on getting the right to vote sustained, getting the right to vote empowered.
Around the U.S., MLK holiday events included marches in several cities, acts of service in King's name, and an annual service at the slain civil rights leader's Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta.
Number three.
Following weeks of soaring infections, the latest COVID surge is showing signs of slowing in a handful of areas hit earliest by the Omicron variant, offering a glimmer of hope that this wave is starting to ease. The U.S. has reported an average of nearly 800,000 cases per day over the past week, more than three times the level seen during last winter's previous record. But in a handful of states and cities, mostly on the East Coast, cases appear to have plateaued or fallen in recent days. 1 year into her tenure as director of the CDC, Rochelle Walensky acknowledged that she hasn't been clear enough. In an interview with the Wall Street Journal, Walensky says she should have made it clearer that new rules and guidelines were subject to change if the nature of the fight against COVID shifted. Only selected spectators will be permitted at next month's Olympics in Beijing because of the pandemic. Beijing had already announced that no fans from outside the country would be permitted at the events and had not offered tickets to the general public. The announcement confirmed expectations the Winter Games will have no crowds.
Hmm. So no feeling, no vibe, no atmosphere.
Nope.
Thank you, Jen. Glad you're with us. The unending pandemic has millions of people feeling like their lives are on hold. Many of them feel their financial growth is on hold, too. Americans began hoarding money in the early days of COVID, but now they're having trouble spending it. It's a story by Veronica Dagger, personal finance reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Veronica, what are you hearing?
Our lives on hold because of this pandemic, and a lot of people feel their financial life is on hold as well. And they have all this extra cash. People have been hoarding cash, frankly. Many people have been hoarding it and been chomping at the bit to spend it. Like, you know, and I think the idea was, you know, once I have all that cash, once I have some extra money, I'm going to go buy, you know, my dream car, or I'm going to be able to buy the house, or go out to eat again and just live the life that the pandemic has been preventing me from living. And they try to do those things, and then they realize because of things like inflation or supply chain issues, they can't act. Like, their dreams are getting stifled, and they're feeling really frustrated.
Boy, perfectly capturing that, too, was this couple from Texas, right? Retired professors.
Right.
They're living in their RV, just waiting to pounce on the building of a new home, and they've already got the land. They're ready to go, but now they're thinking, boy, what are they facing, like a 20% increase in materials costs and such, and they just don't know what to do. They're in limbo, as they said.
They're in limbo, right. They were hoping to build a house for $800,000. It's going to cost them more like $1 million. They weren't counting on that. Like you said, they're retirees, so they need to watch their dollars. And also, not only is there issues with trying to find affordable materials, you know, because the cost of lumber has gone up so much over the last year, but also things like finding the finishes they want. You know, is the refrigerator they want available? And the answer for them was no. That's even on back order. So even once they build the house, a lot of the supplies or the things they want in the house aren't available.
Yeah. We're speaking with Veronica Dagger, personal finance reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Her story is called "People Want to Start Spending Again and Inflation is Ruining It." What's the advice? And you talked to a couple of folks about what to do here.
Right. So, in, you know, there's different situations here. So in the housing market, you know, that's a tough one, right? You need to see what your budget is. But in certain cases, it's kind of a wait and see thing. Maybe you do wait for prices to drop, try to save more and reduce your spending in the meantime so you have more firepower when the house you want does come up. You know, if there's things like, you know, the car you want isn't available, or the vacation you want to take isn't possible right now because of COVID, maybe you want to start thinking about substitutions. So a substitution could actually be driving the car you have a little bit longer, or trading down to a cheaper or more available car, buying that instead, taking, you know, just a little staycation or a shorter vacation, just to, you know, kind of scratch that itch, but also realize that you can eventually do the thing you want to do. You know, I think another issue a lot of people are facing is raises. You know, we've got inflation running higher, much higher than 3% at this point. But some people are getting raises that are about 3%, and they're feeling frustrated about that because they see their purchasing power evaporating before their eyes. And so in addition to asking for the raise, and by the way, don't ask because of inflation, ask because of performance issue. Yeah. That's what a lot of the career coaches will tell you. But think about things like how to maximize your benefits in the meantime, whether it's your health savings or dependent care accounts. You know, maximize that paid training.
Thanks, Veronica. Veronica Dagger, personal finance reporter at the Wall Street Journal. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Morning, America's First News. Podcasts have changed the way you get your news, entertainment, politics, everything. They've rewritten the script, literally. Well, there's another exciting development that's rewritten the script, too. Masterworks. Masterworks enables you to diversify your portfolio and potentially protect it from market volatility by investing in contemporary art with Masterworks. They're the fintech startup shaking up the alternative investing landscape, letting you build a portfolio of fine art without spending millions. Basquiat, Picasso, Warhol. Invest in paintings by iconic artists like these with Masterworks. Their industry-leading research team has created the first and only platform where anyone can buy and trade shares of paintings, giving you the same access enjoyed by some millionaires and billionaires for generations. And now our listeners get priority access to their latest offerings at masterworks.art/Gordon. Join a new generation of investors at masterworks.art/Gordon. See important disclaimers at masterworks.io/disclaimer.
Edgy, smart, bringing you what you need to know. This is America's First News, This Morning with Gordon Deal.
Thanks for spending time with us, and welcome into Tuesday, January 18. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Some of our top stories and headlines. British intelligence says the Texas synagogue terrorist was known to them, and it's not clear how he was given a tourism visa to enter the U.S. The Senate takes up voting rights legislation today. Supreme Court hears arguments today about a group that wants a Christian flag outside Boston City Hall. Volcanic ash delays aid to Tonga after a volcanic eruption. Rams over the Cardinals to finish the NFL wild card weekend. And why drug names are getting so hard to say and spell. That story in about 20 minutes. As the saying goes, never let a crisis go to waste. And with COVID, a growing body of researchers and public health experts are taking that advice literally. Scientists are increasingly using raw sewage as a tool to help determine how infections are trending. It's a story by Kyle Bagenstos, environmental reporter at USA Today. Kyle, explain what happens.
According to the scientists that I talked to, basically you have the sewage treatment plant, like every community in the country has one, you know, and they have their partners, their operators of these plants. They basically every day or a couple times a week collect a little sample of sewage, bottle it up, mail it to a laboratory somewhere, oftentimes overnight, to try and, you know, get the most recent data they can. Scientists take these samples, they run it through the same kind of equipment, the PCR equipment that people are familiar with, a traditional COVID test, and they measure COVID levels in sewage to try and determine what's going on in that population in terms of which way things are trending.
Wow. All right. So what have we learned, say, in various parts of the country at this point?
Yeah, so they've been doing this kind of testing since the start of the pandemic in different places. It's kind of grown in popularity. A lot of cities work with their local academic institutions, but you also see commercial entities really picking up. There's a firm called BioBot Analytics that has over 200 treatment plants across the country that it analyzes. And now they have a pretty robust data set. And the news was that in Boston, which is one of the first places that saw an Omicron spike, scientists saw the first little downtick in terms of the amount of COVID in that city. And it was the first kind of sign that maybe there's a light at the end of the tunnel for Omicron. And actually, in just the past couple of days, they're starting to see this little trend in other communities across the country. So, you know, suggesting momentum that maybe we're starting to, or I've reached the peak and maybe are starting to do the decline of the Omicron wave.
Wow. All right. So you referenced this downtick. Is that, I mean, without getting too much in the weeds here, is that the concentration of the virus is down in the sample? Like, you know, the pink line isn't as bright, you know, for lack of a better analogy?
Yeah, I mean, the way that I understand it is, you know, people might be familiar with the term, you know, viral load or viral shedding. So, you know, when you're symptomatic and can spread COVID, you know, you're breathing it out there, it's going out the thing. Well, the same stuff. Material, you know, ends up in your feces, which ends up at the sewage treatment plant. So they can kind of measure, you know, generally, is the amount trending up or is it trending down? So that's how it works.
Well, we're speaking with Kyle Bagenstos, environmental reporter at USA Today. His story is called When Will This COVID Surge End? Scientists Search Your Sewage for Clues. And who knew, by the way, other than by reading your story, that there was such thing as a sewer coronavirus alert network?
Yeah, that's a group of scientists from across the country. And I think one of the kind of additional leading outfits that are monitoring levels from different cities, and especially in Northern California, to get a pretty good regional look, at least, of how things are trending there.
You said, too, wastewater testing is also providing some advantages as Omicron surges. How so?
Yeah, so, you know, with any time you're doing testing of a person, it relies on a lot of factors. You know, you have to have people actually coming in and getting tests. If you have a home kit, it relies on people, you know, submitting that in. And I think there's some questions about whether Omicron is behaving the same way as past variants in terms of when it shows up on a test as a positive or negative. So there could be a little bit of confusion and play with the numbers there. The beauty of the wastewater testing has been told to me is, of course, everybody pees and poops, right? So yeah, it does not rely on individual kind of behavior in terms of testing. They can get it right from the treatment plant. So it's an extra helpful data point to kind of, you know, see which way things are trending, regardless of how the traditional testing is working out.
Given the questions surrounding the at-home rapid tests, has anybody suggested that we just stick with wastewater testing? Is it quick enough and reliable enough?
You know, I kind of examined this. I, for reasons a bit beyond me, I think it seems like this is mainly viewed as a good 1-2 punch, a good thing to kind of help with surveillance. Yeah, and there are some suggestions that especially as we hopefully, you know, move towards COVID becoming endemic and maybe not as much of a top of mind concern, this could be a useful sentinel to kind of keep running in the background, right? So we don't have to constantly be testing people, having them be showing up. This might be kind of a first line of alert. So I think in the future, we may see this potentially, you know, take some priority as the first method of kind of alerting people.
Thanks, Kyle. Kyle Bagenstos, environmental reporter at USA Today. Hey, thanks for being with us. Welcome into Tuesday. It is time now for the Mic Drop with this morning's Mike Gavin.
Good morning. Well, it's been a minute since we've had some food items to discuss, so let's start with this news about one of America's favorite football foods, potato chips. Just in time for the NFL playoffs, Lay's is giving away bags of their signature chips with some hometown flavor baked in. According to the brand's website, they took dirt from all the NFL stadiums and brought it to Texas, where it was used to grow potatoes that would eventually be made into chips. So now, for example, Bills Mafia can celebrate with a bag of chips made with dirt from Highmark Stadium, while Patriots fans can wallow in their sorrows with some Gillette Stadium flavored chips. Unfortunately, you can't buy them in stores. The bags are available via a sweepstakes on the Lay's website, and there's a limited supply of just 5,800 bags in total. Fans have until a week from today to try to get their hands on a bag.
Hmm. I thought you were going to say initially the dirt was sprinkled in the chips.
Yeah.
for some sort of bizarre flavor.
That's what the headline kind of made it seem like. Yeah, so we had to do a little additional digging here. Now, I know you don't always want, I mean, I assume, look, this is clean dirt, right? Yeah. But I mean, dirt from NFL stadiums isn't always the cleanest stuff. A lot of stuff happens on those fields. A lot of spit coming down from players and who knows what else, you know, goes on the sidelines. Yeah. So, let's hope that this is some pristine dirt that we're dealing with.
Yeah, I don't necessarily want to bring in another brand and take away from the little Lay's promotion here that's happening. You know, they've created this limited supply, right, to pump up the hype, I guess.
Yes, yes.
But if that, like the kettle chips,
right?
You give me those like salt and pepper flavored ones, I could eat them all day.
So like you don't care, like those could be like Patriots branded chips, and you'd still eat them because they're so good. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, yeah.
Right, right. It doesn't matter what team they come from.
No, crinkle cut. Oh yes, with the salt and pepper for fresh ground pepper. Yeah, oh yeah,
yeah.
All day.
I agreed.
With beer, in fact, they pair with lots of things, beer. Lots of different beer. You get Pilsner. You can go IPA with those. You can go red wine. Bourbon. All of it.
Pretty much any liquid. Yeah. Let's face facts. And if nothing else, the TikTok era has given rise to plenty of behind-the-scenes videos showing us how to make our favorite fast foods. The latest making the waves comes from the Essential McDonald's account, which describes the difference between the two types of eggs you'll find at the chain, the folded eggs and the round eggs. In the clip, the user explains that the folded eggs come pre-cooked and squares. Those just get thrown on the grill, arranged neatly with some water thrown in to help them cook. The round eggs, on the other hand, are freshly cooked, cracked into round molds on the grill, and steamed with the help of some water. Commenters on the clip were divided as to which type of egg is better, with some people saying that the round eggs are better since they're more fresh. However, some pointed out that they would never want a round egg after finding shells in them one too many times. In any case, this innocuous video about fast food egg cooking has found an audience with over 12 million views since being posted just 3 days ago.
Wow.
Yeah, people like watching eggs being cooked at McDonald's, apparently.
I'm not necessarily a round egg versus folded egg. Is there sausage and cheese with that egg? That's my egg.
Because the egg is really just, I don't know. There's not a lot of taste there, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's just kind of a blanket to put the sausage and cheese on, right? It's a vessel to help deliver the sausage and cheese to you.
It's like a stocking on Christmas. Like it's nice, but it's not fully necessary to carry out the holiday and all the gift giving.
Right. All you have to do, you know, in the you had only one job scenario here, just don't let their shells get into the eggs. That's all we care about.
Yeah. Thank you, Mike. Uncomfortable work attire is a thing of the past. If you're still trapped in suits and ties, make it your New Year's resolution to go casual at work. But don't dress down. Get some casual style that fits anywhere. That's what Cuts Clothing is designed for, to fit you and any occasion perfectly. That's how I feel about my t-shirts from Cuts. They look and feel great. Buttery soft. They move with me whenever I'm at the mic or at the gym. And while I could go on about their custom-engineered Pika Tri-Blend fabric, you really have to wear it to understand how soft it is. It's the ultimate blend of high-quality cotton, polyester, and spandex. The result is what GQ magazine calls the only shirt worth wearing. And now it's worth even more because it's an even better value. Cuts Clothing is work leisure apparel for the sport of business. Get 15% off your first order by going to cutsclothing.com/Gordon. That's CUTS. cutsclothing.com/Gordon for 15% off the only shirt worth wearing. cutsclothing.com/Gordon. Thanks for being with us. In the wake of multiple deadly fires in recent weeks, fire safety advocates are calling on Americans to take steps to prevent another tragic blaze. MarketWatch has tips on what you can do to avoid devastating fires. Number one, act quickly. On average, how about this? People only have 3 minutes to escape compared to 17 minutes for similar fires 40 years ago. The use of synthetic materials has been shown to accelerate the spread of fires. Number two, be mindful of the common causes. Heating a home is the second leading cause of home fires, mostly from space heaters. The most common cause of fires is cooking. Number three, create a fire safety plan. Many high-rise buildings are designed so flames will be contained to a single unit. In these cases, staying inside might be safer than smoke-filled stairwells and hallways. Number four, close the doors to prevent flames and smoke from traveling. And number five, maintain smoke detectors. 60% of fire-related deaths happen in a home where they're not working properly. 8 minutes now in front of the hour on This Morning. Once again, here's Jennifer Koschenka.
And now, the three big things you need to know. Number one.
Facing stark criticism from civil rights leaders, senators return to Capitol Hill under intense pressure to change their rules and break a Republican filibuster that has stalled voting legislation. The Senate is set to launch debate today on the voting bill, with attention focused intently on two pivotal Democrats, Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona and Joe Manchin of West Virginia, who were singled out yesterday in a barrage of criticism during Martin Luther King Jr. Day events.
Number two.
A rabbi who endured a tense 10-hour standoff at a Texas synagogue says he and other hostages fled after he threw a chair at the assailant. Rabbi Charlie Citron Walker spoke to CBS hours after the FBI released a statement calling the standoff a terrorism-related matter in which the Jewish community was targeted. Citron Walker also led a prayer service at his synagogue yesterday.
At the root of Dr. King Jr.'s beautiful teaching, love is the only force capable of transforming an enemy into a friend.
The 44-year-old man who took the rabbi and others hostage was killed by an FBI SWAT team.
Number three.
Ash cloaking a runway has hampered relief efforts in Tonga as the scale of the damage from a volcanic eruption and a tsunami becomes clear. New Zealand is trying to send clean drinking water and other supplies, but planes cannot land at the main airport. Alexander Mathieu is with the Red Cross.
We are all a bit in the dark about exactly the scale of damage or what people are experiencing.
Two people have been reported dead, but with communications limited, there are fears the true toll could be higher. The increase in antibodies produced by a fourth shot of a COVID vaccine is not enough to prevent infections from Omicron, according to preliminary research from an Israeli hospital. The results bring into question the practice of giving a second booster dose when large parts of the world are facing a shortage of vaccines. Well, if you've got the bucks, you too could own a 16th century villa in Rome. Villa Aurora, filled with masterpieces from antiquity to the Renaissance, is at the center of an inheritance battle between a Texas-born princess and her stepsons, and it goes up for auction today. The starting price, $534 million, with bidding rising in increments of more than $1
million. $534
million? You got
What's the plumbing and heating and air conditioning like in a place from the 1500s? Wow. Thanks, Jen. Thanks for being with us. Hundreds of millions of people have gotten the Pfizer and Moderna COVID vaccine shots, but not many know that the Pfizer vaccine is called Comirnaty and that Moderna's is called Spikevax. The Wall Street Journal says one reason is that naming requirements are really complex. 2 years ago, a team from the Brand Institute began working on vaccine names. BioNTech, which developed its vaccine with Pfizer, wanted one to reflect its groundbreaking use of messenger RNA, or mRNA. But mRNA sounded a lot like Mirena, the name of a birth control device. It also echoed Moderna, which was developing a rival vaccine. The team spent months considering names like Ranaxcovi, Covimerna, Covuity, and Comirnaty, the eventual winner. Above all, the drug's name cannot look or sound like another. The FDA conducts handwriting tests to make sure the name isn't easily confused with another when prescriptions are being filled. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Morning, America's First News. Do you own or rent your home? Sure you do. Fortunately, GEICO makes it easy to bundle your home and car insurance. It's a good thing, too, because having a home is hard work. Go to GEICO.com, get a quote, and see how much you could save. GEICO.com. Easy.